The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
The day after, there's uncertainty. What is clear, Latinos came out big time for Joe Biden in Arizona. It took years of work and rejecting bigotry.
Many of us decided to roll up our sleeves and said, we're not going to leave Arizona. It's our home.
How Latinos turned out across the country and global reaction to a vote that's not yet decided from China.
Doesn't matter who would win. China would do the same. Defend its own interest.
To England.
It's not for a candidate to decide which votes do and don't count or when to stop counting. The next president must be the free and fair choice of the American people.
And we wait. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World on the day after the big vote. Election officials continue to count ballots in battleground states. That means we do not have a winner yet. Today on the show, we'll have reaction to the vote from around the world. But first, a look at one of the big worries going into Election Day, foreign interference. What ended up happening on the cybersecurity and disinformation front? And what could we expect next? The World's Lydia Emanuelidou is with me. In the lead up to the vote yesterday, Lydia, we'd been speaking with election security experts about their concerns. Remind us what was at the top of their list, and did any of them actually materialize?
Yeah, there were a few concerns. One was that there would be widespread attacks on voter registration rolls to make it impossible for officials to access voter registration information, which would cause chaos on Election Day and beyond Election Day. Thankfully, this doesn't seem to have happened. Another concern was that websites that are reporting results would be hacked into and false results would be displayed. This is something that Russia actually did in Ukraine in 2014, so this wouldn't be unprecedented. But again, this doesn't seem to have materialized here in the U.S. However, there were some scary moments nonetheless.
What kind of scary moments?
There are a few examples. There was an internet outage at an elections office in Florida that local media there were reporting would delay results. In one county in Ohio, there was an issue with the electronic poll books that poll workers were using to check voters into a precinct location. Then in parts of Georgia, there were voting machine outages. In Texas, a website that was reporting out election results went down temporarily. But none of this, Marco, appears to have been the work of a hacker, let alone a foreign government.
Right. So no successful cyber attacks on the U.S. election system, it seems.
Right. That seems to be the case so far, although I should say there are election security experts who are saying, let's not celebrate too quickly. It's possible that there were issues that we haven't discovered or that there will be issues in the days ahead as the results are coming out.
Another thing I know you're watching, Lydia, is mis- and disinformation on social media. We know from intelligence reports and from independent experts that Russia and other actors used social media in 2016 to elevate false stories and divisive issues. What are we seeing this time around?
This time around, we're seeing a lot of the misinformation coming from the U.S. side and from the president himself. Already, President Trump has claimed victory in a speech he gave overnight, early this morning, and on social media. He started tweeting early this morning about Democrats stealing the election and his lead, you know, quote unquote, magically disappearing. Twitter put warnings on those tweets like they said they would because they were misleading and they contained false information. And there's all sorts of other misinformation going around on social media at the moment. There's, for example, there's a hashtag that Trump supporters and pundits, mostly on the right, have been posting under. It's the Stop the Steal hashtag, meaning stop the steal of the election, even though, again, there's no evidence that there's any stealing going on. So these are the kinds of tweets and messages and hashtags that experts say foreign actors might try to boost in the coming days as we wait for election results. And by boost, I mean, you know, sharing the tweets, commenting on the tweets that are already under the hashtag or posting new ones.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of describing Russia's playbook. Tap into existing divisions, divide people even more. And that's what we saw in 2016.
Right. And again, the goal of these kinds of operations is to not only divide people, but to undermine faith in our systems and in our democracy. And right now, we're in the perfect environment for this kind of misinformation and disinformation to thrive. We have a really close race. The final results could take days, some people say weeks, to come out. And in the meantime, people with both good and bad intentions are putting out information. At the same time, emotions are really high. We have people in the U.S. who are rightfully terrified about the election results, and a country that's really divided. And all of that makes us really vulnerable to false information, whether it's coming from foreign actors or our own politicians, which, again, is mostly what we've seen so far this election.
The World's Lydia Emanuelidou, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
There's a lot at stake in the U.S. election for our neighbors in Mexico, so no surprise that President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is being careful not to pick sides just yet.
A mí me satisface de que no hay...
That's López Obrador saying he's pleased the uncertainty in the U.S. has not, so far, had an impact on the Mexican economy. The World's Jorge Valencia has more from Mexico City.
The reaction from Mexicans who pay attention to U.S. politics, well, similar to the way Americans are feeling.
Okay, so it's been a rough night, to be really sincerely honest.
A strange feeling, very strange situation, not correct.
Alejandra Tenorio supports Joe Biden, and Juan Juan Peña Neder supports Donald Trump. Tenorio lives in Parral, Chihuahua, a small city a few hours south of Texas.
We're surrounded from mountains. That's basically what we live in.
And Peña Neder.
I'm a lawyer and I'm in Mexico City.
Alejandra Tenorio is an English teacher. She was born in Dayton, Ohio, and that is where she submitted her absentee ballot. She says she's upset to see Donald Trump declaring victory while several key states are still counting their votes.
Voto por voto. O sea, we have to get counted and we have to respect every single vote. It's not a fraud. I mean, election is not over until every single absentee ballot is counted.
Meanwhile, Juan Juan Peña Neder does not vote in the U.S., but he says he convinced friends in the United States to vote for Trump. And he says he doesn't understand why there wasn't an official winner more quickly.
In Mexico, we cannot understand those kind of things because we have a very sophisticated electoral system with a central election system and register. And that's just incredible.
Alejandra Tenorio says she spent the night on the phone with friends and family in Missouri and Texas, but that the last few months she spent trying to persuade American voters who live in Mexico to vote for Biden.
I really got amazed these couple of months where I was just getting out the vote, getting out that every single U.S. citizen that is living in Mexico can vote, because most of it, they don't know. And I really got amazed about that.
According to one estimate, 2 million American citizens live south of the border. And for those who vote, like Tenorio, one key issue under President Donald Trump has been immigration.
I mean, I live in Mexico and my two siblings live in the United States, and they're younger than me. And of course, I am searching for a better country, a better economy, a kindlier with immigration country.
Meanwhile, Juan Juan Peña Neder worked with fellow Trump supporters in Mexico to get them to speak with friends and relatives who are U.S. citizens and live in the United States.
The mothers and fathers and cousins and brothers can talk to their sons or relatives and say, we understand better why Donald Trump proposed you that or those and you must go to vote.
Peña Neder says an issue in which Trump has been positive for Mexico is in the economy. He says the newly renegotiated U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement is good for the whole region, and that under Trump's leadership, the U.S. can help Mexico with what he believes is an economic adversary the two countries have in common.
China, it's a very destabilizing factor in the world trade, but Mexico feels the politics of President Trump provide more possibilities to growing up because now we are a partner with huge possibilities.
Either way, the uncertainty of the election and the way Donald Trump is handling it is surprising for many political observers in Mexico. Veronica Ortiz Ortega directs the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations.
In Latin America, I would say, but particularly in Mexico, and as a Mexican, I know that we are used to having everyone claiming victory beforehand and then claiming fraud. So it does surprise us when it is the president of the United States questioning the integrity of the system of the United States.
Ortiz Ortega says that she expects and hopes that regardless of who sits in the White House for the next 4 years, Mexico and the U.S. will continue to have strong collaborative ties. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Let's turn now to China. The World Shanghai correspondent Rebecca Canther is on the line to walk us through what she's been seeing there. Rebecca, hey, what was it like there on election night?
Well, your election night was our morning. So, you know, right from 7 in the morning, people were paying attention to the results. In the morning, I stopped by the Camel, which is a bar where a lot of Americans and Europeans were hanging out. It was on the first floor, so people walking by could see in and see the big TVs. And I saw this young Chinese mom standing outside with her son, and she was just quietly saying, "Go Biden!" So I stopped and talked with her. Her name is Bernice. Her husband went to school in the U.S., and they actually live in California, but they're here in Shanghai, which is her hometown, because of COVID. And they're trying to figure out whether to move back to their home in California. And she told me she was worried about Trump's stance on immigration and foreigners.
So we're still like debating because like for now, like we don't know like how the attitude like toward Asians, because Trump was making like coronavirus, like the Chinese virus. That's why that like we don't know the attitude because we're kind of like still debating.
So she's concerned about Trump's position on immigration. What other policies are important to Chinese people you've spoken with, Rebecca?
Well, I checked into a very different kind of watch party later in the day. I was video chatting with this group of 6 high school and college students. They're all attending American and Canadian schools, but they can't get to the U.S. right now. So they're all living together in an apartment in Hangzhou, which is a city near to Shanghai. And they had made their own little watch party. They were cooking together. They set up a projector. And they were focused on policies that would impact them.
I mean, the entire house is rooting for Biden, but it's not looking good. We're pretty young, and we're leaning towards the progressive side of things, like LGBTQ rights, racial justice and stuff. And then also just because how, you know, as an international student, like our interests are on the line.
Yeah, so she was saying how she felt like Trump was using China kind of like a political tool to gain popularity, but that had really impacted their experience in the U.S. and they felt more discriminated against. But she also said it was going to impact, you know, policies for their study and work visas, which would make a real difference on whether they're actually able to go back to their schools in the U.S. But also, you know, as students, they were just interested to observe an election. So this is Bowen Zheng. He's a philosophy major at Lake Forest College.
I'm interested in politics in general because, you know, we don't really have that much politics in China. Yeah, so we don't have this kind of like democratic voting and stuff. So I'm just interested in that in general.
So what is the impact of a Trump win or a Biden win in China?
So I talked to Shending Li. He's a professor of Sino-American relations, and he was kind of blasé about it.
Doesn't matter who would win. China would do the same. Defend its own interest, working with America whenever possible. And if America does not want to work with China, it says, oh, fine.
So I think what he's expressing is this feeling that I heard a lot of people talking about, that whether Trump or Biden wins, Sino-American relations are really, they're in a bad state right now, and that might not improve if one person or another wins. But I talked to Guo Hanfeng. She runs these educational exchange programs between the U.S. and China. And she was telling me that there's support for Trump in China for a reason that has nothing to do with what's going on in America.
But I still can see some people support Trump more than Biden here. I think it's because some people like the challenge to our governmental authority. If their work has no relationship with foreign country, they don't feel the conflict will influence their life. They are happy to see the conflict.
So I was talking to another woman, Joanna Shun, and she was reading about the election from USA Today, because that's one of the only media that wasn't blocked in China. And she was telling me how her opinion of Trump has changed. Back in 2016, she saw him kind of as a clown, and now she likes him.
I think my impression is that previously when the Democratic Party was the U.S. government, they tried to exert some kind of influence to the Chinese government. But I mean, it's all just talk, you know. It feels like Trump can exert real pressure, you know.
I thought that was really interesting that there's a couple different ways to think about how the election impacts China. One is thinking about U.S.-China relations. And then another is just how things might change in China. People seem to be reading into the election as if it might change politics here. I'm not sure how accurate that is or not, but it was interesting that people were having that hope.
It is a fascinating takeaway. Well, we are watching, people in China are watching, and the world's Rebecca Cather in Shanghai will continue watching. Rebecca, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. No matter where you are on Earth, there is no escaping this election.
Y el vicepresidente Joe Biden también se mostró.
Une fois, c'est Donald Trump qui ment, qui veut déstabiliser notre système d'élection.
Выборщиков в Мичигане и Висконсине, затягивающая с подсчетом Пенсильвания.
As the vote count goes on, foreign leaders are deciding what to say, if anything. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
As soon as Trump said this,
we will win this, and we, as far as I'm concerned, we already have won it. So I just want to thank you.
The head of First Lady Melania Trump's home country, Slovenia, said this.
Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša has handed Donald Trump victory in the 2020 United States presidential election.
Prime Minister Janša congratulated President Trump for his alleged victory on Twitter, as did former Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini. Donning a Trump 2020 face mask, he wrote, quote, "A great victory for Biden was promised in all the newspapers. As usual, they didn't get it right." In Germany, Parliament member Norbert Röttgen told national media that the country was, quote, "not prepared to see a Trump victory." But other global leaders are playing the waiting game, like the rest of us, as votes continue to be counted across the country. China's foreign ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said today, "We notice that the U.S. presidential election is still ongoing, and the result hasn't come out yet." Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he's watching the race, but isn't yet picking up the phone to make a congratulatory call.
We will allow the American elections, obviously, to unfold as they will, and Canada will watch.
Same goes for the European Commission, according to a spokesperson.
This House will not comment on the results until they have been announced.
Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha Gonzalez-Laya also urged American leaders to wait until all the votes have been counted. And Australian Labour Senator Penny Wong tweeted, "Americans have voted in historic numbers in this election. They deserve to have their voices heard." In Brazil, domestic aides to President Bolsonaro, a major Trump ally, have reportedly advised him to wait until results are official before commenting. So far, so good. But while we wait, pro-Kremlin lawmaker Vyacheslav Nikonov gave advice to Russians on Facebook. He said, "The result of the elections is the worst outcome for America. Both candidates claim their victory. Let's stock up on large quantities of popcorn." For now,
the race for president remains much too close to call.
Too close to call right now.
It is too close to call.
Remains too close to call.
The world will have to hold its breath a little longer. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
All year long, we've been following how young Latinos across the country might vote. There are still a few battleground states left to call and a lot left to unpack. The World's Daisy Contreras joins me. She leads our Every 30 Seconds project. Hi, Daisy.
Hey, Marco.
We gave the project that name because every 30 seconds a Latino in the U.S. turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote. So how was the turnout of young Latino voters?
It's probably still too early to say with accuracy what the turnout by state looks like, Marco, but there is already data out about early voting numbers. And this was a good surprise for organizations across the country that have been pushing to get more Latinos out to vote. 2020 early voting numbers surpass previous years like never before. This year, nearly 2 million young Latinos voted early. That's Latinos ages 18 to 29. In 2016, though, 135,000 roughly young people voted early. It's a threefold increase. I spoke to Dorian Cal. He is with Naleo Educational Fund. It's a nonpartisan group focused on Latino civic engagement. Cal and his team have been tracking Latino voters across the country these last few weeks. They were already looking into the mail-in votes and the numbers there.
You know, we were expecting some of that. Certainly, we were expecting some Latinos in the Latino community to really choose mail-in voting. But again, just the numbers were quite impressive.
So, as you said, that was a pleasant surprise. What else have you found surprising, Daisy, and what have you found not surprising?
The main takeaway is this. How Latinos voted isn't surprising for those of us who've been following it. It certainly isn't surprising for Latinos in these communities. One example is Florida, and I go there because this is a state that gets to form this narrative around all Latino voters early on during Election Day. Yes, the majority of Latinos there voted for the Republican candidate as we expected they would. This has been consistent, as they did in other states across the country. Florida gives us one angle with multiple stories. Certainly, this information campaigns, socialism, and the narratives around socialism played a role, but people are not one-dimensional, so that's what hasn't been surprising.
Yeah, I'm curious about Trump's win in Florida. What do we know about how his campaign reached out to Latino communities there in that state?
The Trump campaign focused its outreach there, and it really paid off, not just with Latinos from certain backgrounds, but also with white voters. We're seeing some numbers coming out with that information. It also wasn't one way, of course. There were also many, many groups supporting Trump, and they were campaigning for him. So these were conservative Latinos in, like, Latinos for Trump groups pushing to connect with the Trump campaign, and they were pushing and hoping to get recognized by the campaign. They hosted roundtable discussions all year with local business leaders in different cities and invited Trump to come over and talk to those leaders. So certainly this is how the Trump campaign was able to maximize its reach.
And what can we say about Biden's outreach in Florida or even more generally?
Generally, his campaign didn't do enough to reach enough Latino communities, and we heard about this from multiple campaign strategists throughout the year. Biden needed to cover a lot more ground. We're hearing that from Puerto Ricans in Florida, for example, who many of them turned out to vote for Trump. There were a lot of opportunities there for the Biden campaign to come in and try to reach those voters. So, yes, a lot of it comes down to outreach and not connecting. So because Biden still had a long way to go, grassroots organizations did that outreach for him, or at least tried, much like what groups did for Trump. One Get Out the Vote group, Voto Latino, even went as far as endorsing Biden. They've never endorsed a candidate before. So in many ways, on-the-ground groups picked up the slack, especially after Bernie Sanders dropped out of the race.
In the second half of the show today, we'll be hearing more about the striking energy in Arizona, where the Latino vote specifically helped flip the state to blue. Daisy, what are you going to be looking into as more results start coming in?
I'm really interested in how local communities voted. This year, many organizations pushed to get more Latinos registered to vote, especially young Latinos. Texas was hoping to flip from red to blue, and organizations on the ground were really hoping that by getting a lot of young Latinos out to register and then out to vote, they would be able to achieve that. But as we've seen so far right now, that wasn't the case, at least this year. If we've learned something, change and impact takes years of work, as we will see in Arizona later on.
The world's Daisy Contreras, who heads up our Every 30 Seconds project. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
There will be a lot more to unpack in the coming weeks on how Latinos in the U.S. are part of political life. But one thing has always been true, and this moment underscores this: Latino voters are not a monolithic block. There is not a Latino vote. All through this election year, the world has been covering the stories of Latino voters who represent that political diversity. You can read and hear those stories at theworld.org/every30seconds. You're listening to The World. The stakes are high around the world with this election, so too with this period of uncertainty.
The United States is so distracted with its own domestic politics. I see Afghanistan and the peace process getting neglected for a period of time.
Global reaction to the U.S. vote, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. The top story in Great Britain today is, what else, the U.S. election. It's not that surprising. The Brits typically keep a close eye on American politics. That was yesterday, though. At 1 minute past midnight tonight, England goes back into lockdown. So people in the U.K. will either see our election as the best thing on TV, or maybe they'll be too distracted by lockdown to be bothered. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry is in London. How does this American political story look from there, Orla?
There's really two stories today, the U.S. election and lockdown, and the U.S. election is very much at the top of all of that. As one person said to me earlier, I feel like this is the most important election of my lifetime, and I don't even have a vote in it, nor do I even live in the country. Wow. So, you know, it gives a kind of a perspective. But have a listen. This is the opening of Parliament earlier today, Marco, and the first question that was put to the Prime Minister by the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, this morning.
Can I start with the elections in the United States? Whatever the results, will the Prime Minister join me in saying that it's not for a candidate to decide which votes do and don't count, or when to stop counting? The next president must be the free and fair choice of the American people.
We have the Prime Minister's response, so take a listen.
Well, Mr. Speaker, in the answer to his opening question, of course, we don't comment as a UK government on the democratic processes of our friends and allies, and I don't think in all seriousness he would expect otherwise.
A very diplomatic response, unlike some other EU representatives today. Boris Johnson didn't condemn the tweet by President Trump this morning, but what Keir Starmer was saying there, the opposition leader, is something that you hear a lot here today, that the reputation of democracy itself is at stake, and also a sort of a reflection on America in terms of its position globally and how other countries view America right now.
Is that a discussion you're hearing widely in the UK today? America's role on the world stage going forward, even while this vote count continues and uncertainty hangs in the air?
Certainly that broader issue is being brought up, and not least because I think here in Europe there has been very much the sense that the EU has become less important in the eyes of the US, and what changed or what was damaged in terms of the relationship between the EU and the US may never go back to what it once was, but it is perceived that that relationship has been damaged. In fact, the former UK ambassador to the US, Sir Nigel Sheinwald, was quite cutting in terms of the perception of the US to the rest of the world right now when he was talking to the BBC a little earlier.
This year, 2020, with coronavirus and a very, very divisive and unpleasant election, has definitely diminished the world's view of America. And the question is, what comes out at the other end? Is it an America reinvigorated, or is it an America which continues to underperform on the world stage and fail to understand where the rest of the world is?
What comes out on the other end? For folks in the UK, Orla, I mean, this has got to be such a long and wild political tale playing out on the other side of the ocean. But how important is the actual result to the UK?
Well, quite important, actually, because the reality for the UK is that the US is its single biggest trading partner outside of the EU, and a future trade agreement with the US post-Brexit will be very important to Britain. I mean, talks are still underway with the EU in terms of a trade deal, but the thinking here has been that if Trump were to win, it would be easier for Boris Johnson to go for a no-deal option and walk away from talks with Brussels. And just to explain that, the big fear of a no-deal Brexit is the impact it would have on Northern Ireland and the very real possibility it could result in the introduction of a hard border in Ireland. But Joe Biden has been quite upfront in the last few months saying that if anything happens that brings back a hard border or jeopardises peace in Northern Ireland because of Brexit, he won't negotiate a trade deal with Britain. That said, Marco, you know, not everyone thinks actually it will make that much of a difference. And I spoke to former trade negotiator David Hennig about this a little earlier, and he actually reckons a trade deal between the two countries under Trump wouldn't look all that different than one organised under Biden.
There's always been a sense that President Trump understood the Brexit project, but to be honest, it wasn't really backed up with anything useful for the UK. We weren't going to get a special trade deal, just the trade deal that probably will still be on offer under President Biden at some point.
That point by David Hennig I've seen repeated by a few people who have been close to the Brexit talks, who essentially have said that they don't actually think it will make that big a difference who ends up in the White House.
We have spoken before, Orla, about this bromance between Trump and Boris Johnson. It has kind of faded, it feels, but is there anything to say about the relationship between the British Prime Minister and Joe Biden?
Yeah, not too much yet. I mean, it's has been said here that Biden sees Boris Johnson and his government as being a little bit too like Trump, which doesn't bode well, I guess, for their future bromance. But then, I should say, many have said because Trump and Boris Johnson actually got along. What does the UK have to show for that relationship? You know, what improvements did the UK get out of all of this? Trump was reportedly, as you can probably guess, quite difficult to deal with in terms of 10 Downing Street. So it's very possible that foreign diplomats are thinking, well, it might be a relief to deal with someone that's a little less temperamental this time around. And also in terms of policy issues, I guess, Boris Johnson would be closer to Joe Biden in terms of his thinking on Russia and on China and certainly on climate change.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
The 2020 election has been a test like no other for American democracy. When democratic norms are trampled on, it can be hard to smooth things back out again. Kenya, for example, it had been the most stable multi-party democracy in Africa for decades. Then in 2007, a deeply divisive and contested presidential election took Kenya into a violent period. About 1,500 people died, another 600,000 were displaced from their homes. In some ways, the country is still recovering. Nanjala Nyabola is a writer and political analyst based in Nairobi. She's the author of Digital Democracy, Analog Politics, How the Internet Era is Transforming Politics in Kenya. Nanjala, the 2007 presidential election in Kenya pitted the incumbent Mwai Kibaki against Raila Odinga, the then opposition candidate. What exactly happened that touched off the unexpected violence that followed?
The actual vote in 2007 in Kenya was very peaceful. And then we had 2 days of uncertainty and 2 days of waiting to see what would happen next. And when the Electoral Commission finally started announcing results, there had been so much ambivalence in that two-day period that when the opposition called for protests, there was not only a massive public mobilization, but then there was also the counter-mobilization by the police and the police violence that followed that. But the spark that sort of set everything off, that lit the tinderbox, was actually this uncertainty about what had actually happened to the votes that had been peacefully cast in December 27, that numbers were being manipulated, that we couldn't actually accept or agree that the numbers that we were being told were actually the truth about the electoral process. It's that anxiety that drives people to seek out other avenues of having their voice heard. It's that uncertainty that led people to start that first wave of protest. Then the cycle of anxiety and the cycle of reprisals and counter-reprisals touched off the worst political violence, certainly the worst citizen-on-citizen political violence that we've seen in Kenya since independence.
The U.S. right now, as you know, is in a period of uncertainty, for we don't really know about who the next president is going to be. What do you see at risk here from where you are in Nairobi? What are you looking for?
The thing that I've been paying closest attention to in the U.S. election is the postal ballots. Because as we know, because of the coronavirus, an unprecedented number of Americans voted through postal ballots, used absentee ballots, voted from overseas. And I think that there's been a significant effort to disrupt the process of both casting and counting postal ballots. And regardless of who wins the election, regardless of, you know, who is called as the winner within the next 2 or 3 days, what happens to those postal ballots is going to deeply affect the confidence that Americans have in American institutions, in the American democratic institutions, to deliver free, fair, credible elections. And I think that people, analysts, watchers, you know, U.S. political partisans are not really paying enough attention to this issue. It's going to have an impact beyond the vote. If people start to believe that the post office is somehow serving a partisan agenda, and not the people who work in the post office, but really the post office as an institution, it's going to undermine a lot more than just this election. It's going to leave people asking questions about democratic participation. Is it even worth it? Is it worth it to be part of a government where I can be disfranchised so easily? And so that's what I've been paying attention to, because it has such rhythms to what happened in Kenya with the Electoral Commission of Kenya. We don't have postal voting in Kenya. We don't have absentee ballots. So the Electoral Commission of Kenya was the institution on which all this confidence hinged, and the consequences were so grave.
So what do you think are the lessons from Kenya's episode in 2007 that are relevant to the United States today, especially as it relates to democratic participation?
Well, I think that we have all been reminded that every vote counts. Again, when you look at the margins, especially in some of these swing states, I think we have to count every vote in order to maintain the integrity of the electoral process. I think the lessons from Kenya are that you can't take democracy for granted. We got complacent after we had 2 successful votes within a 4-year period, and then woke up to the worst political crisis that we're still dealing with, probably since independence, but certainly since the start of the multi-party era. You know, the lessons that Kenya gives to the United States is that we have to really be vigilant about everything and stay focused on what the goal is. The goal is not a successful election, and the goal is not, you know, to have a peaceful vote. The goal is democracy, and democracy is a marathon. It's not a sprint. Every step counts, but also we have to keep an eye on the bigger picture and what we want this political project that is the United States to look like in future.
I mean, whoever is the next president of the United States, the fact remains that this country is deeply divided. Any suggestions for how Americans come back together? I mean, what happened in Kenya in 2012?
Well, what happened in Kenya is that we papered over a lot of deep-seated issues. We started off a really powerful process of reconciliation and reconstruction. We had national dialogues. We had major impetus to go to the root of the issues that really affected the country and democracy in the country. And then we dropped the ball. And I think that's what I would advise citizens of the U.S. to really start to think about. One is there are things that are not political about political opinion. There are divisions that are not to do with politics, but are actually are much more fundamental, are about the rights of people and about life. And so, for example, racism is not a political debate. It's a human dignity debate. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. And I think starting off the conversation with, hey, we recognize that this is bigger than just electoral politics, that these are fundamental injustices that have to be dealt with, is one part of the battle. And I think that's what I would say to people in the U.S. to pay attention to.
Nanjala Nyabola is a Kenyan writer and political analyst. Her latest book is called Traveling While Black, Essays Inspired by a Life of Travel. She joined us from Nairobi. Thank you very much, Nanjala.
Thank you.
As you've heard throughout the program today, the whole world is reacting to the U.S. election and this limbo period where we wait to hear who won and which way the U.S. goes next in the world. Iran and Afghanistan are two places that play big into American foreign policy. And like the rest of us, they're also waiting for the news. The World's Shirin Jafari joins me now. I know you've been following reaction from Iran, Shirin. What are people talking about there?
Marco, the news is all over the headlines in Iran today. I was going through some of the front pages of the newspapers today, and there are lots of clever headlines that play with words and phrases. Let me just give you one example. One paper carries the headline, quote, "The American Showdown." And the teaser reads, "Will the American president accept the outcome of the elections?" And just a reminder that the Iranian government has for a long time presented the U.S. as the enemy of the Iranian people. And up until now, the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, has been mostly quiet about the U.S. election. But just yesterday, he broke that silence.
رئیس جمهوری که الان سر کار هست و انتخابات رو او بناس برگزار کنه او میگه که
So Marco, he is the supreme leader in a televised speech yesterday, and he said that the president of the U.S., the incumbent, has been casting doubts about the election. And he goes on to add in a kind of like a mocking way that, quote, "This is American democracy for you." The supreme leader also said that for Iran, it doesn't really matter who wins the election, but what does matter is if the policies of the American government changes or not.
Yeah, so what are the policies that Iranians are hoping to see after Inauguration Day in January? What do they want?
So we have the policies that the Iranian government would be interested in, but then we also have the policies that the Iranian people would prefer. And for them, what my reporting has shown is that people are really feeling the pain of the economy and the sanctions that the U.S. has been imposing on Iran. And what they would love to see is for these sanctions to be eased so that they can do business with the outside world and so that they can travel more easily. So for them, it's a question of whether or not the next administration will ease those sanctions or not.
Another country you've reported a lot on, Shirin, is Afghanistan, another kind of center for American foreign policy. What are you hearing from Afghanistan today? How have Afghans followed this American election?
So as you know, there's a peace deal that the Taliban and the U.S. negotiated back in February. And in that agreement, the U.S. promised to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan if the Taliban and the Afghan government come to an agreement. And President Trump has said that he wants the American troops out of Afghanistan by Christmas, although his military officials haven't agreed to that. And in the meantime, Marco, the violence in Afghanistan has been going up drastically in the past few weeks. There have been several attacks that we have reported on the show carried out by the Islamic State. The most recent one was this week at University of Kabul that killed at least 20 students, and people are still coming to terms with the death of these students. The government has announced a day of mourning to honor the victims. And so security is a big concern for people in Afghanistan today.
It is horrible for Afghans. The violence just seems to go on. So looking ahead, what needs to happen with these peace talks, Shirin, if they're actually trying to end the war?
So there's a cloud over these negotiations. The Afghan representatives have been meeting with the Taliban in Doha, but the progress has been very slow. This week, I spoke with Esfandiar Mir, who studies jihadi groups in Afghanistan, and I asked him this question. I said, what do you think the election in the U.S., what kind of impact will it have on the Afghan peace negotiations? And here's what he said.
Unfortunately, the United States is so distracted with its own domestic politics. So I see Afghanistan and the peace process getting neglected for a period of time, and I expect that the status quo will kind of persist.
You know, Marco, Amir said the next president in the U.S. has a lot on his plate. There are so many immediate issues that he has to deal with. For example, the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, and all the divisiveness in the country. So those are going to be priority for the next president, and maybe Afghanistan will come after that.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for your time.
No problem, Marco.
If you are constantly hitting refresh for the latest election news, come on over to theworld.org. You'll find all of our coverage of the international consequences of the U.S. presidential race. We've also got a state-by-state election map refreshing the vote totals every 30 seconds. All the national data and global context of the U.S. election at your fingertips at theworld.org/2020election. Early this morning, the Associated Press called the state of Arizona for Democrat Joe Biden, saying President Trump had no path to victory there. State officials have not officially named a winner yet. Arizona has not thrown its weight behind a Democratic presidential contender since 1996. But if Biden does flip the state blue, it'll be in large part due to years of organizing by immigrant rights groups.
It was a big coalition that was very diverse that really made Arizona happen. And I would say that a lot of that energy was ignited by the anti-immigrant rhetoric and policies that we have experienced for the past two decades.
That's DACA recipient Reyna Montoya. She leads the group Aliento, an immigrant aid organization based in Phoenix.
If you want to understand Arizona politics, you have to go back to early 2000s and how we started seeing waves of anti-immigrant legislation from not having access to in-state tuition for Dreamers, from English-only laws, banning ethnic studies, to having the famous Show Me Your Papers law. So it's definitely been years where the immigrant community was terrorized. And the little children who were terrorized are now growing up. Young people are paying attention. And now that's one of the biggest things that we're seeing as the result.
A lot of us see roots of this flip to the blue column in the battle to oust controversial former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. I think a lot of listeners will remember President Trump pardoned him in 2017 despite charges of abusive conditions in Maricopa County jails, accusations of misuse of public resources. Does the organizing strategy start there, or was it before the Arpaio stuff?
Definitely the fear that former Sheriff Joe Arpaio created within the communities was very palpable. And I think that ignited a lot of people. I now work with young people who are 18 years old, who are children of undocumented parents. And this was their first presidential election. And they decided to come out because they remember that when they were 9-10 years old, a very coming of age event was getting a flip phone just so you can dial your auntie or your uncle in case if your mom or dad couldn't make it. I remember we had that conversation with my brother and saying, hey, if there's an emergency, this is who do you dial? Because we were so scared about not knowing if going to the grocery store would be the last date that we would see mom and dad.
Why did the outreach to Latino voters appear to work in Arizona but not elsewhere?
There has been deep years of investment and commitment. I am a Dreamer, I'm a DACA recipient myself, and I remember traveling to different immigration convenience and people saying like, oh, are you from Arizona? Like, why don't you just leave? And I think many of us decided to roll up our sleeves and said, we're not going to leave Arizona. It's our home. And it takes commitment. It takes time. And it takes a lot of dedication. At the end of the day for Arizona, it has never been about being blue or red. It's been about how do we make sure we bring power to the communities who have been marginalized, in this case, the Latinx and the immigrant community.
When it comes to immigration policies and whether they work or not, Arizona's right there at the border and has a really powerful perspective on events. Were there moments in the last 3 years that really caught voters' attention more than other states, perhaps, and made them realize that perhaps the Democrats have a solution?
Many people were very outraged when they started seeing the pictures of little children being separated by their families. We now have close to 500 children that were separated, and they don't have mom and dad, and parents were deported, and they don't have justice as little kids. I think another big effort that we have seen is the role of DACA and DACA recipients and undocumented youth who were too young to apply for the DACA program. I get to work with a lot of undocumented students that don't have the ability to pay in-state tuition, and we're seeing that that was something that Arizonans really care about. They care about education, they care about immigration, and obviously healthcare in the wake of a pandemic and seeing so many lives being taken away due to COVID-19 and having the Latino community being disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 were some of the top issues that really ignited the community to wanting to have change and do something different.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you, Reyna, whether the pandemic, you think, played a role in how Arizona residents voted.
From all the calls that we had, I mean, it was very evident that people were very worried. We at Aliento helped close to 500 families with $500 cash assistance. So we're talking about over $200,000 of investment that we did with the communities because they were so desperate. They were systematically excluded by our federal government that if you had a loved one, either your husband, your wife, your son who was undocumented, in your taxes, you were excluded from any economic relief from the federal government. So I think that created a lot of energy. We also started seeing that in specific zip codes here in Arizona, in the very high peak of the pandemic during the summer, there were predominantly precincts and neighborhoods that were heavily populated by the Latino and Latinx community. So for us, definitely, we heard those calls and those cries on the phone saying, we gotta do something because our lives depend on it.
Reyna, for you as an immigrant rights activist, what is the big lesson from what happened in Arizona?
The big lesson is that when there's investment in the community who has been impacted and marginalized for years, you would see results. It takes time, it takes commitment, and it takes dedication. And that's what we have seen in Arizona, that it's not about being blue or being red, but at the end of the day, it's about what are the policies that are impacting our neighbors, that are impacting our communities. And when we see pain, when we see hurt, when we see a very anti-immigrant rhetoric, it's not going to work. And I think that is a big lesson that the United States can take from us.
Reyna Montoya in Phoenix. She's the founder and CEO of the immigrant aid organization Aliento. Thank you so much for your time, Reyna.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that two words will be remembered this year: wait and patience. Wait for the lockdown to lift. Wait for a vaccine. Wait for November 3rd. And now be patient while the whole world waits for results. And that's just the big picture. Now think about all the things you've been waiting for and been patient about. I'll let you fill in those blanks while Van Morrison takes us out today. On a golden autumn day returning, where each moment never is the same, sometimes pure joy comes with patience. This is The Waiting Game.
Well, I'm waiting on Waiting Game.
Van Morrison there from 1997, before he started defying science on the coronavirus, but that's another story.
Must be a reason for all this.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online 24/7 at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Stay strong, be patient, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
Sometimes I'm looking for perfection.
KPRX.